Disc 8.
If you go very still, Breeda said after dark, you can feel the spirits. I think I fell asleep instead. But sometime toward dawn I awoke and found Breeda was also asleep. I sat up carefully, so as not to wake her, and I stared into the dark, and I went very still and listened for the Shadegengen. Goblins and elves and sprites and spectres and dwarves, all those things come to Midgard at night and prowl among the trees. And when we guarded the charcoal piles, both Breeda and I put out food for them so they would leave us in peace. So I woke, I listened, and I heard the small sounds of a wood at night, the things moving, the claws in the dead leaves, the wind's soft sighs. And then I heard the voices. I woke Breeda, and we were both still. Nitgenga growled softly until Breeda whispered that he should be quiet. Men were moving in the dark, and some were coming to the charcoal pile, and we slipped away into the blackness under the trees. We could both move like shadows, and Nitgenga would make no sound without Breeda's permission. We had gone uphill because the voices were downhill, and we crouched in utter darkness and heard men moving around the charcoal pile. And then there was the crack of flint and iron, and a small flame sprung up. Whoever it was searched for the folk they reckoned would be watching the charcoal, but they did not find us, and after a while they moved downhill, and we followed. Dawn was just leeching the eastern sky with a wolf-grey edge. There was frost on the leaves and a small wind. "We should get to Ragnar," I whispered. "We can't," Breeda said. And she was right, for there were scores of men in the trees, and they were between us and the hall, and we were much too far away to shout a warning to Ragnar, and so we tried to go around the strangers, hurrying along the hill's ridge so we could drop down to the forge where Old Wolf slept. But before we had gone halfway, the fires burst into life. That dawn is seared on my memory, burnt there by the flames of a hall burning. There was nothing we could do except watch. Kjartan and Sven had come to our valley with over 100 men, and now they attacked Ragnar by setting fire to the thatch of his hall. I could see Kjartan and his son, standing amid the flaming torches that lit the space in front of the door, and as folk came from the hall, they were struck by spears or arrows, so that a pile of bodies grew in the firelight, which became ever brighter as the thatch flared and finally burst into a tumultuous blaze that outshone the light of the grey dawn. We could hear people and animals screaming inside. Some men burst from the hall with weapons in hand, but they were cut down by the soldiers who surrounded the hall, men at every door or window, men who killed the fugitives, though not all of them. The younger women were pushed aside under guard, and Thyra was given to Sven, who struck her hard on the head and left her huddled at his feet as he helped kill her family. I did not see Ravan, Ragnar, or Sigrid die, though die they did, and I suspect they were burned in the hall when the roof collapsed in a roaring gout of flame, smoke, and wild sparks. Eldwulf also died, and I was in tears. I wanted to draw serpent breath and rush into those men around the flames, but Breeda held me down, and then she whispered to me that Kjartan and Sven would surely search the nearby woods for any survivors, and she persuaded me to pull back into the lightening trees. Dawn was a sullen iron band across the sky, and the sun, cloud-hidden in shame as we stumbled uphill to find shelter among the fallen rocks deep in the high wood. All that day, the smoke rose from Ragnar's hall, and the next night there was a glow above the tangled black branches of the trees, and the next morning there were still wisps of smoke coming from the valley where we had been happy. We crept closer, both of us hungry, to see Kjartan and his men raking through the embers. They pulled out lumps and twists of melted iron, a mail coat fused into a crumpled horror, silver welded into chunks, and they took whatever they found that could be sold or used again. At times they appeared frustrated, as if they had not found enough treasure, though they took enough. A wagon carried Old Wolf's tools and anvil down the valley. Thyra had a rope put around her neck, was placed on a horse, and led away by one-eyed Sven. Kjartan pissed on a heap of glowing cinders, then laughed as one of his men said something. By afternoon they were gone. I was 16 and no longer a child. And Ragnar, my lord who had made me his son, was dead. The bodies were still in the ashes, though it was impossible to tell who was who, or even to tell men from women, for the heat had shrunk the dead, so they all looked like children, and the children like babies. Those who had died outside the hall were recognisable, and I found Eldwulf there, and Andwend, both stripped naked. I looked for Ragnar but could not identify him. I wondered why he had not burst from the hall, sword in hand, and decided he knew he was going to die and did not want to give his enemy the satisfaction of seeing it. We found food in one of the storage pits that Kjartan's men had missed as they searched the hall. We had to shift hot, charred pieces of timber to uncover the pit, and the bread, cheese and meat had all been soured by smoke and ash, but we ate. Neither of us spoke. At dusk, some English folk came cautiously to the hall and stared at the destruction. They were wary of me, thinking of me as a Dane, and they dropped to their knees as I approached. They were the lucky ones, for Kjartan had slaughtered every Northumbrian in Sinningthwaite, down to the last baby, and had loudly blamed them for the hall burning. Men must have known it was his doing, but his savagery at Sinningthwaite confused things. And in time, many folk came to believe that the English had attacked Ragnar, and Kjartan had taken revenge for their attack, but these English had escaped his swords. "You will come back in the morning," I told them, "and bury the dead."
"Yes, Lord."
"You will be rewarded," I promised them, thinking I would have to surrender one of my precious arm rings.
"Yes, Lord,"
one of them repeated. And then I asked them if they knew why this had happened, and they looked nervous. But finally one said he had been told that Earl Ragnar was planning a revolt against Riksig. One of the Englishmen who served Kjartan had told him that when he went down to their hovels to find ale. He had also told them to hide themselves before Kjartan slaughtered the valley's inhabitants. "You know who I am?" I asked the man.
"The Lord Uhtred, Lord."
"Tell no man I'm alive," I said, and he just stared at me. Kjartan, I decided, must think that I was dead, that I was one of the shrunken, charred bodies in the hall, and while Kjartan did not care about me, Sven did, and I did not want him hunting me. "And return in the morning," I went on, "and you will have silver." There is a thing called the blood feud. All societies have them. Even the West Saxons have them, despite their vaunted piety. Kill a member of my family and I shall kill one of yours. And so it goes on, generation after generation, or until one family is all dead. And Kjartan had just wished a blood feud on himself. I did not know how. I did not know where. I could not know when. But I would revenge Ragnar. I swore it that night. And I became rich that night. Breda waited until the English folk were gone, and then she led me to the burned remnants of Eldwulf's forge, and she showed me the vast piece of scorched elm, a section of a tree's trunk that had held Eldwulf's anvil. "We must move that," she said. It took both of us to tip over that monstrous piece of elm, and beneath it was nothing but earth. But Breda told me to dig there, and for want of other tools I used wasp sting, and had only gone down a handbreadth when I struck metal. Gold. Real gold. Coins and small lumps. The coins were strange, incised with a writing I had never seen before. Neither Danish runes nor English letters, but something weird that I later learned came from the people far away who live in the desert and worship a god called Allah, who I think must be a god of fire, because Al, in our English tongue, means burning. There are so many gods, but those folk who worshipped Allah made good coin, and that night we unearthed 48 of them, and as much again in loose gold. And Breeder told me she had watched Ragnar and Eldwulf bury the hoard one night. There was gold, silver pennies, and 4 pieces of jet, and doubtless this was the treasure Kjartan had expected to find, for he knew Ragnar was wealthy, but Ragnar had hidden it well. All men hide a reserve of wealth for the day when disaster comes. I have buried hoards in my time, and even forgot where one was, and perhaps, years from now, some lucky man will find it. That hoard, Ragnar's hoard, belonged to his eldest son, but Ragnar, it was strange to think he was just Ragnar now, no longer Ragnar the Younger, was far away in Ireland, and I doubted he was even alive, for Kjartan would surely have sent men to kill him. But alive or dead, he was not here, and so we took the hoard. What do we do? Breeder asked that night. We were back in the woods. I already knew what we would do. Perhaps I had always known. I am an Englishman of England, but I had been a Dane while Ragnar was alive, for Ragnar loved me and cared for me and called me his son. But Ragnar was dead, and I had no other friends among the Danes. I had no friends among the English, for that matter, except for Breeder, of course. And unless I counted Beoka, who was certainly fond of me in a complicated way. But the English were my folk, and I think I had known that ever since the moment at Aesk's Hill, where for the first time I saw Englishmen beat Danes. I had felt pride then. Destiny is all, and the spinners touched me at Aesk's Hill, and now at last I would respond to their touch. We go south, I said. To a nunnery? Breeder asked, thinking of Elswith and her bitter ambitions. No. I had no wish to join Alfred and learn to read and bruise my knees with praying. I have relatives in Mercia, I said. I had never met them, knew nothing of them, but they were family, and family has its obligations. And the Danish hold on Mercia was looser than elsewhere. And perhaps I could find a home, and I would not be a burden because I carried gold. I had said I knew what I would do, but that is not wholly true. The truth is that I was in a well of misery, tempted to despair, and with tears ever close to my eyes. I wanted life to go on as before, to have Ragnar as my father, to feast and to laugh. But destiny grips us, and the next morning in a soft winter rain we buried the dead, paid silver coins, and then walked southward. We were a boy on the edge of being a grown man, a girl and a dog, and we were going to nowhere. Part 2. The Last Kingdom. Chapter 7. I settled in southern Mercia. I found another uncle, this one called Ealdorman Ethelred, son of Ethelred, brother of Ethelwulf, father of Ethelred, and brother to another Ethelred, who had been the father of Elswith, who was married to Alfred. And Ealdorman Ethelred, with his confusing family, grudgingly acknowledged me as a nephew, though the welcome became slightly warmer when I presented him with 2 gold coins and swore on a crucifix that it was all the money I possessed. He assumed Breeder was my lover, in which he was right, and thereafter he ignored her. The journey south was wearisome, as all winter journeys are. For a time we sheltered at an upland homestead near Meslak, and the folk there took us for outlaws. We arrived at their hovel in an evening of sleet and wind, both of us half frozen, and we paid for food and shelter with a few links from the chain of the silver crucifix Elswith had given me. And in the night, the 2 eldest sons came to collect the rest of our silver. But Breeder and I were awake, half expecting such an attempt, and I had serpent breath, and Breeder had wasp sting, and we threatened to geld both boys. The family was friendly after that, or at least geared into docility, believing me when I told them that Breeder was a sorceress. They were pagans, some of the many English heretics left in the high hills, and they had no idea that the Danes were swarming over England. They lived far from any village, grunted prayers to Thor and Odin, and sheltered us for 6 weeks. We worked for our keep by chopping wood, helping their ewes give birth, and then standing guard over the sheep pens to keep the wolves at bay. In early spring we moved on. We avoided Hraepandun, for that was where Burgred kept his court, the same court to which the hapless Egbert of Northumbria had fled, and there were many Danes settled around the town. I did not fear Danes. I could talk to them in their own tongue, knew their jests, and even liked them. But if word got back to Jofrik that Uhtred of Bebbanburg still lived, then I feared Kjartan would put a reward on my head. So I asked at every settlement about Elderman Ethelwulf, who had died fighting the Danes at Reddingham, and I learned he had lived at a place called Deereby, but that the Danes had taken his lands, and his younger brother had gone to Chirinchester, which lay in the far southern parts of Mercia, very close to the West Saxon border. And that was good, because the Danes were thickest in Mercia's north. And so we went to Chirinchester, and found it was another Roman town, well walled with stone and timber, and that Ethelwulf's brother, Ethelred, was now Ealdorman and lord of the place. We arrived when he sat in court, and we waited in his hall among the petitioners and oath-takers. We watched as two men were flogged, and a third branded on the face and sent into outlawry for cattle thieving. And then a steward brought us forward, thinking we had come to seek redress for a grievance. And the steward told us to bow, and I refused. And the man tried to make me bend at the waist, and I struck him in the face. And that got Ethelred's attention. He was a tall man, well over 40 years old, almost hairless except for a huge beard, and as gloomy as Guthrum. When I struck the steward, he beckoned to his guards who were lolling at the hall's edges.
"Who are you?" he growled at me.
"I am the Ealdorman Uhtred," I said, and the title stilled the guards and made the steward back nervously away. "I am the son of Uhtred of Bebbanburg," I went on, "and of Ethelgifu, his wife. I am your nephew." He stared at me. I must have looked a wreck, for I was travel-stained and long-haired and ragged, but I had two swords and monstrous pride. "You are Ethelgifu's boy?" he asked. "Your sister's son," I said. And even then I was not certain this was the right family. But it was, and Ealdorman Ethelred made the sign of the cross in memory of his younger sister, whom he hardly remembered, and waved the guards back to the hall's sides and asked me what I wanted. "Shelter," I said, and he nodded grudgingly. I told him I had been a prisoner of the Danes ever since my father's death, and he accepted that willingly enough, but in truth he was not very interested in me. Indeed, my arrival was a nuisance, for we were two more mouths to feed. But family imposes obligation, and Ealdorman Ethelred met his. He also tried to have me killed. His lands, which stretched to the River Severn in the west, were being raided by Britons from Wales. The Welsh were old enemies, the ones who had tried to stop our ancestors from taking England. Indeed, their name for England is Hlogir, that means the lost lands, and they were forever raiding or thinking of raiding or singing songs about raiding. And they had a great hero called Arthur who was supposed to be sleeping in his grave, and one day he was going to rise up and lead the Welsh to a great victory over the English, and so take back the lost lands. Though so far that has not happened. About a month after I arrived, Ethelred heard that a Welsh warband had crossed the Severn, and was taking cattle from his lands from Fromton, and he rode to clear them out. He went southward with 50 men, but ordered the chief of his household troops, a warrior called Tatwine, to block their retreat near the ancient Roman town of Gloucester. He gave Tatwine a force of 20 men that included me.
"You're a big lad," Ethelred said to me before he left. "Have you ever fought in a shield wall?"
I hesitated, wanting to lie, but decided that poking a sword between men's legs at Reddingham was not the same thing. "No, Lord," I said.
"Time you learned. That sword must be good for something. Where did you get it?"
"It was my father's, Lord," I lied, for I did not want to explain that I had not been a prisoner of the Danes, nor that the sword had been a gift, for Ethelred would have expected me to give it to him.
"It is the only thing of my father's I have," I added pathetically.
And he grunted, waved me away, and told Tatooine to put me in the shield wall if it came to a fight. I know that because Tatooine told me so when everything was over. Tatooine was a huge man, as tall as me with a chest like a blacksmith's, and thick arms on which he had made marks with ink and a needle. The marks were just blotches, but he boasted that each one was a man he had killed in battle, and I once tried to count them, but gave up at 38. His sleeves hid the rest. He was not happy to have me in his band of warriors, and even less happy when Breeda insisted on accompanying me, but I told him she had sworn an oath to my father never to leave my side, and that she was a cunning woman who knew spells that would confuse the enemy, and he believed both lies, and probably thought that once I was dead his men could have their joy of Breeda while he took Serpent Breath back to Ethelred. The Welsh had crossed the Severn high up, then turned south into the lush water meadows where the cattle grew fat. They liked to come in fast and go out fast, before the Mercians could gather forces. But Ethelred had heard of their coming in good time, and as he rode south, Tatooine led us north to the bridge across the Severn, which was the quickest route home to Wales. The raiders came straight into that trap. We arrived at the bridge at dusk, slept in a field, were awake before dawn, and just as the sun rose, saw the Welshmen and their stolen cattle coming toward us. They made an effort to ride farther north, but their horses were tired, ours were fresh, and they realized there was no escape, and so they returned to the bridge. We did the same and dismounted, formed the shield wall. The Welsh made their wall. There were 28 of them, all savage-looking men with shaggy hair and long beards and tattered coats, but their weapons looked well cared for, and their shields were stout. Tatooine spoke some of their language, and he told them that if they surrendered now, they would be treated mercifully by his lord. Their only response was to howl at us, and one of them turned around, lowered his breeches and showed us his dirty backside, which passed as a Welsh insult. Nothing happened then. They were in their shield wall on the road, and our shield wall blocked the bridge, and they shouted insults, and Tatooine forbade our men to shout back. And once or twice, it seemed as if the Welsh were going to run to their horses and try to escape by galloping northward. But every time they hinted at such a move, Tatooine ordered the servants to bring up our horses, and the Welsh understood that we would pursue and overtake them, and so they went back to the shield wall and jeered at us for not assaulting them. Tatooine was not such a fool. The Welshmen outnumbered us, which meant that they could overlap us. But by staying on the bridge, our flanks were protected by its Roman parapets, and he wanted them to come at us there. He placed me in the centre of the line, and then stood behind me. I understood later that he was ready to step into my place when I fell. I had an old shield with a loose handle, loaned to me by my uncle. Tatooine again tried to persuade them to surrender, promising that only half of them would be put to death, but as the other half would all lose a hand and an eye, it was not a tempting offer. Still they waited, and might have waited until nightfall had not some local people come along, and one of them had a bow and some arrows, and he began shooting at the Welsh, who by now had been drinking steadily through the morning. Tatooine had given us all some ale, but not much. I was nervous. More than nervous, I was terrified. I had no armour, while the rest of Tatooine's men were in mail or good leather. Tatooine had a helmet, I had hair. I expected to die, but I remembered my lessons and slung Serpent Breath on my back, strapping her sword belt around my throat. A sword is much quicker to draw over the shoulder, and I expected to begin the fight with Wasp Sting. My throat was dry. A muscle in my right leg quivered. My belly felt sour. But entwined with that fear was excitement. This was what life had led to. A shield wall. And if I survived this, then I would be a warrior. The arrows flew one after the other, mostly thumping into shields. But one lucky shaft slid past a shield and sank into a man's chest, and he fell back. And suddenly the Welsh leader lost patience and gave a great scream. And they charged. It was a small shield wall, not a great battle. A cattle skirmish, not a clash of armies. But it was my first shield wall, and I instinctively rattled my shield against my neighbour's shields to make sure they touched. And I lowered Wasp Sting, meaning to bring her up under the rim, and I crouched slightly to receive the charge. And the Welsh were howling like madmen, a noise meant to scare us. But I was too intent on doing what I had been taught to be distracted by the howls. "Now!" Tatooine shouted. And we all lunged our shields forward, and there was a blow on mine like Eldwulf's hammer thumping the anvil. And I was aware of an axe swinging overhead to split my skull, and I ducked, raising the shield, and stabbed Wasp Sting up into the man's groin. She went smooth and true, just as Toki had taught me, and that groin stroke is a wicked blow, one of the killer strikes. And the man screamed a terrible scream, just like a woman in childbirth, and the short sword was stuck in his body, blood pouring down her hilt, and the axe tumbled down my back as I straightened. I drew serpent breath across my left shoulder and swung at the man attacking my right-hand neighbour. It was a good stroke, straight into the skull, and I ripped her back, letting Eldwulf's edge do its work. And the man with Wasp Sting in his crotch was under my feet, so I stamped on his face. I was shouting now, shouting in Danish, shouting their deaths. And it was all suddenly easy. And I stepped over my first victim to finish off the second. And that meant I had broken our shield wall, which did not matter because Tatooine was there to guard the space. I was in the Welsh space now, but with two dead men beside me. And a third man turned on me, sword coming in a great scything stroke that I met with the shield boss. And as he tried to cover his body with his own shield, I lunged serpent breath into his throat, ripped her out, swung her all the way around, and she clanged against a shield behind me. And I turned, all savagery and anger now, and I charged a fourth man, throwing him down with my weight. And he began to shout for mercy and receive none. The joy of it. The sword joy. I was dancing with joy. Joy seething in me. The battle joy that Ragnar had so often spoken of. The warrior joy. If a man has not known it, then he is no man. It was no battle, that. No proper slaughter. Just a thief killing. But it was my first fight and the gods had moved in me, had given my arm speed and my shield strength. And when it was done, and when I danced in the blood of the dead, I knew I was good. Knew I was more than good. I could have conquered the world at that moment, and my only regret was that Ragnar had not seen me. But then I thought, he might be watching from Valhalla. And I raised serpent breath to the clouds and shouted his name. I have seen other young men come from their first fights with that same joy, and I have buried them after their next battle. The young are fools, and I was young, but I was good. The cattle thieves were finished. 12 were dead, or so badly wounded as to be near death, and the others had fled. We caught them easily enough, and one by one we killed them. And afterward, I went back to the man whose shield had kissed mine when the walls clashed, and I had to put my right foot into his bloody crotch to drag Wasp Sting free of his clinging flesh. And at that moment, all I wanted was more enemies to kill.
"Where did you learn to fight, boy?" Tatooine asked me.
I turned on him, as though he was an enemy, pride flaring in my face. and Wasp-Sting twitching as if she was hungry for blood. "I am an Elderman of Northumbria," I told him. He paused, wary of me, then nodded. "Yes, Lord," he said, then reached forward and felt the muscles of my right arm. "Where did you learn to fight?" he asked, leaving off the insulting boy. "I watched the Danes."
"Watched?" he said tonelessly.
He looked into my eyes, then grinned and embraced me.
"God love me," he said, "but you're a savage one. Your first shield wall?"
"My first," I admitted.
"But not your last, I dare say. Not your last."
He was right about that. I have sounded immodest, but I have told the truth. These days I employ poets to sing my praises, but only because that is what a lord is supposed to do, though I often wonder why a man should get paid for mere words. These word stringers make nothing, grow nothing, kill no enemies, catch no fish, and raise no cattle. They just take silver in exchange for words, which are free anyway. It is a clever trick, but in truth they are about as much use as priests. I did fight well, that is no lie, but I had spent my growing years dreaming of little else, and I was young, and the young are reckless in battle, and I was strong and quick, and the enemy were tired. We left their severed heads on the bridge parapets as a greeting for other Britons coming to visit their lost lands. Then we rode south to meet Ethelred, who was doubtless disappointed to find me alive and still hungry, but he accepted Tatooine's verdict that I could be useful as a fighter. Not that there would be much battle, except against outlaws and cattle thieves. Ethelred would have liked to fight the Danes because he fretted under their rule, but he feared their revenge and so took care not to offend them. That was easy enough, for Danish rule was light in our part of Mercia. But every few weeks some Danes would come to Chirencester and demand cattle or food or silver, and he had little choice but to pay. In truth, he did not look north to the impotent King Burgred as his lord, but south to Wessex. And had I possessed any intelligence in those days, I would have understood that Alfred was extending his influence over those southern parts of Mercia. The influence was not obvious. No West Saxon soldiers patrolled the country, but Alfred's messengers were forever riding and talking to the chief men, persuading them to bring their warriors south if the Danes attacked Wessex again. I should have been wary of those West Saxon envoys, but I was too caught up in the intrigues of Ethelred's household to pay them any notice. The Elderman did not like me much, but his eldest son, also called Ethelred, detested me. He was a year younger than I, but very conscious of his dignity, and a great hater of the Danes. He was also a great hater of Breeder, mainly because he tried to hump her and got a knee in the groin for his trouble, and after that she was put to work in Elderman Ethelred's kitchens, and she warned me the very first day not to touch the gruel. I did not, but the rest of the table all suffered from liquid bowels for the next 2 days, thanks to the elderberries and iris root she had added to the pot. The younger Ethelred and I were forever quarrelling, though he was more careful after I beat him with my fists the day I found him whipping Breeder's dog. I was a nuisance to my uncle. I was too young, too big, too loud, too proud, too undisciplined, but I was also a family member and a lord, and so Alderman Ethelred endured me and was happy to let me chase Welsh raiders with Tatooine. We almost always failed to catch them. I came back from one such pursuit late at night and let a servant rub down the horse while I went to find food, and instead, of all people, discovered Father Willibald in the hall where he was sitting close to the embers of the fire. I did not recognise him at first, nor did he know me when I walked in all sweaty with a leather coat, long boots, a shield and 2 swords. I just saw a figure by the fire. "Anything to eat there?" I asked, hoping I would not have to light a tallow candle and grope through the servants sleeping in the kitchen.
"Ughtred?" he said,
and I turned and peered through the gloom. Then he whistled like a blackbird and I recognized him.
"Is that Breeder with you?" the young priest asked.
She was also in leather, with a Welsh sword strapped to her waist. Neat Genger ran to Willibald, whom he had never met, and allowed himself to be stroked. Tatooine and the other warriors all tramped in, but Willibald ignored them.
"I hope you're well, Latrid."
"I'm well, Father," I said.
"And you?"
"I'm very well," he said. He smiled, obviously wanting me to ask why he had come to Ethelred's hall, but I pretended to be uninterested.
"You didn't get into trouble for losing us?" I asked him instead. "The Lady Elswith was very angry," he admitted. "But Alfred seemed not to mind. He did chide Father Beorka, though."
"Beorka? Why?"
"Because Beorka had persuaded him you wanted to escape the Danes, and Beorka was wrong. Still, no harm done," he smiled. "And now Alfred has sent me to find you."
I squatted close to him. It was late summer, but the night was surprisingly chilly, so I threw another log onto the fire so that sparks flew up, and a puff of smoke drifted into the high beams.
"Alfred sent you," I said flatly. "He still wants to teach me to read?"
"He wants to see you, Lord."
I looked at him suspiciously. I called myself a lord, and so I was by birthright, but I was well imbued with the Danish idea that lordship was earned, not given, and I had not earned it yet. Still, Willibald was showing respect.
"Why does he want to see me?" I asked.
"He would talk with you," Willibald said. "And when the talk is done, you are free to come back here, or indeed go anywhere else you wish."
Breeder brought me some hard bread and cheese. I ate, thinking. "What does he want to talk to me about?" I asked Willibald.
"God?"
The priest sighed.
"Alfred has been king for 2 years, Uhtred, and in those years he has had only two things on his mind, God and the Danes. But I think he knows you cannot help him with the first."
I smiled. Ethelred's hounds had woken as Tatooine and his men settled on the high platforms where they would sleep. One of the hounds came to me, hoping for food, and I stroked his rough fur, and I thought how Ragnar had loved his hounds. Ragnar was in Valhalla now, feasting and roaring and fighting and whoring and drinking, and I hoped there were hounds in the Northman's heaven, and boars the size of oxen, and spears sharp as razors.
"There is only one condition attached to your journey," Willibald went on, "and that is that Breeder is not to come."
"Breeder's not to come, eh?" I repeated.
"The Lady Elswith insists on it," Willibald said.
"Insists?"
"She has a son now," Willibald said. "God be praised, a fine boy called Edward."
"If I was Alfred," I said, "I'd keep her busy too." Willibald smiled.
"So, will you come?"
I touched Breeder, who had settled beside me. "We'll come," I promised him, and Willibald shook his head at my obstinacy, but did not try to persuade me to leave Breeder behind.
Why did I go?
Because I was bored. Because my cousin Ethelred disliked me. Because Willibald's words had suggested that Alfred did not want me to become a scholar, but a warrior.
I went because fate determines our lives.
We left in the morning. It was a late summer's day, a soft rain falling on trees heavy with leaf. At first we rode through Ethelred's fields, thick with rye and barley, and loud with the rattling noise of corn crakes. But after a few miles we were in the wasteland that was the frontier region between Wessex and Mercia. There had been a time when these fields were fertile, when the villages were full and sheep roamed the higher hills, but the Danes had ravaged the area in the summer after their defeat at Erske's Hill, and few men had come back to settle the land. Alfred, I knew, wanted folk to come here to plant crops and rear cattle, but the Danes had threatened to kill any man who used the land, for they knew as well as Alfred that such men would look to Wessex for protection, that they would become West Saxons and increase the strength of Wessex, and Wessex, as far as the Danes were concerned, existed only because they had yet to take it. Yet that land was not entirely deserted. A few folk still lived in the villages, and the woods were full of outlaws. We saw none, and that was good, for we still had a fair amount of Ragnar's hoard that Breda carried. Each coin was now wrapped in a scrap of rag, so that the frayed leather bag did not clink as she moved. By day's end we were well south of that region, and into Wessex, and the fields were lush again and the villages full. No wonder the Danes yearned for this land. Alfred was at Wintonchester, which was the West Saxon capital, and a fine town in a rich countryside. The Romans had made Wintonchester, of course, and Alfred's palace was mostly Roman, though his father had added a great hall with beautifully carved beams, and Alfred was building a church that was even bigger than the hall, making its walls from stone that were covered with a spiderweb of timber scaffolding when I arrived. There was a market beside the new building, and I remember thinking how odd it was to see so many folk without a single Dane among them. The Danes looked like us, but when Danes walked through a market in northern England, the crowds parted, men bowed, and there was a hint of fear. None here. Women haggled over apples and bread and cheese and fish, and the only language I heard was the raw accents of Wessex. Breda and I were given quarters in the Roman part of the palace. No one tried to part us this time. We had a small room, lime-washed, with a straw mattress, and Willibald said we should wait there, and we did until we got bored with waiting, after which we explored the palace, finding it full of priests and monks. They looked at us strangely, for both of us wore arm rings cut with Danish runes. I was a fool in those days, a clumsy fool, and did not have the courtesy to take the arm rings off. True, some English wore them, especially the warriors, but not in Alfred's palace. There were plenty of warriors in his household. Many of them the great eldermen who were Alfred's courtiers, led his retainers and were rewarded by land. But such men were far outnumbered by priests, and only a handful of men, the trusted bodyguard of the king's household, were permitted to carry weapons in the palace. In truth, it was more like a monastery than a king's court. In one room there were a dozen monks copying books, their pens scratching busily, and there were three chapels, one of them beside a courtyard that was full of flowers. It was beautiful, that courtyard, buzzing with bees and thick with fragrance. Neat Genga was just pissing on one of the flowering bushes when a voice spoke behind us. "The Romans made the courtyard." I turned and saw Alfred. I went on one knee, as a man should when he sees a king, and he waved me up. He was wearing woolen breeches, long boots and a simple linen shirt, and he had no escort, neither guard nor priest. His right sleeve was ink-stained. "You are welcome, Uhtred," he said. "Thank you, Lord," I said, wondering where his entourage was. I had never seen him without a slew of priests within fawning distance, but he was quite alone that day. "And Breda," he said, "is that your dog?" "He is," she said defiantly. "He looks a fine beast. Come." He ushered us through a door into what was evidently his own private chamber. It had a tall desk at which he could stand and write. The desk had four candle holders, though as it was daylight the candles were not lit. A small table held a bowl of water so he could wash the ink off his hands. There was a couch, covered in sheepskins, a stool on which were piled six books and a sheaf of parchments, and a low altar on which was an ivory crucifix and two jewelled reliquaries. The remains of a meal were on the window ledge. He moved the plates, bent to kiss the altar, then sat on the ledge and began sharpening some quills for writing. "It is kind of you to come," he said mildly. "I was going to talk with you after supper tonight, but I saw you in the garden, so thought we could talk now." He smiled, and I, lout that I was, scowled. Breda squatted by the door, with Neat Genga close to her. "Ealdorman Ethelred tells me you are a considerable warrior, Uhtred," Alfred said.
"I've been lucky, Lord."
"Luck is good, or so my own warriors tell me. I have not yet worked out a theology of luck, and perhaps I never will. Can there be luck if God disposes?"
He frowned at me for a few heartbeats, evidently thinking about the apparent contradiction, but then dismissed the problem as an amusement for another day.
"So I suppose I was wrong to try to encourage you to the priesthood."
"There's nothing wrong with encouragement, Lord," I said, "but I had no wish to be a priest."
"So you ran away from me? Why?"
I think he expected me to be embarrassed and to evade his question, but I told him the truth. "I went back to fetch my sword," I told him. I wished I had serpent breath at that moment, because I hated being without her. But the palace doorkeeper had insisted I give up all my weapons, even the small knife I used for eating. He nodded seriously, as if that was a good reason.
"It's a special sword?"
"The best in the world, Lord." He smiled at that, recognizing a boy's misplaced enthusiasm.
"So you went back to Earl Ragnar?"
I nodded this time, but said nothing.
"Who did not hold you prisoner, Uhtred," he said sternly. "Indeed, he never did he? He treated you like a son."
"I loved him," I blurted out.
He stared at me, and I became uncomfortable under his gaze. He had very light eyes that gave you the sense of being judged. "Yet in Jofrek," Alfred went on mildly, "they are saying you killed him."
Now it was my time to stare at him. I was angry, confused, astonished and surprised. So confused that I did not know what to say. But why was I so surprised? What else would Kjartan claim? Except I thought Kjartan must have thought me dead, or I hoped he thought me dead.
"They lie," Breda said flatly.
"Do they?" Alfred asked me, still in a mild voice. "They lie," I said angrily.
"I never doubted it," he said. He put down his quills and knife and leaned over to the heap of stiff parchments that rested on his pile of books and sifted through them until he found the one he was looking for. He read for a few moments. "Kjartan, is that how it is pronounced?"
"Kjartan," I corrected him, making the J sound like a Y.
"Earl Kjartan now," Alfred said, "and reckoned to be a great lord, owner of 4 ships.
"That's all written down?" I asked.
"Whatever I discover of my enemies is written down," Alfred said. "Which is why you are here, to tell me more. Did you know Ivar the Boneless is dead?"
My hand instinctively went to Thor's hammer, which I wore under my jerkin.
"No."
"Dead?" It astonished me. Such was my awe of Ivar that I suppose I had thought he would live forever. But Alfred spoke the truth. Ivar the Boneless was dead.
"He was killed fighting against the Irish," Alfred said. "And Ragnar's son has returned to Northumbria with his men."
"Will he fight Kjartan?" "If he knows Kjartan killed his father," I said, "he'll disembowel him."
"Earl Kjartan has sworn an oath of innocence in the matter," Alfred said.
"Then he lies."
"He's a Dane," Alfred said, "and the truth is not in them."
He gave me a sharp look, doubtless for the many lies I had fed him over the years. He stood then and paced the small room. He had said that I was there to tell him about the Danes, but in the next few moments he was the one who did the telling. King Burgred of Mercia, he said, was tired of his Danish overlords and had decided to flee to Rome.
"Rome?" "I was taken there twice as a child," he said, "and I remember the city as a very untidy place," that was said very sternly. "But a man feels close to God there, so it is a good place to pray. Burgred is a weak man, but he did his small best to alleviate Danish rule. And once he is gone, then we can expect the Danes to fill his land. They will be on our frontier. They will be in Chirinchester. He looked at me. Kjartan knows you're alive.
He does?
Of course he does. The Danes have spies just as we do.
And Alfred's spies, I realized, had to be efficient, for he knew so much.
Does Kjartan care about your life? He went on. If you tell the truth about Ragnar's death, Uhtred, then he does care, because you can contradict his lies. And if Ragnar learns that truth from you, then Kjartan will certainly fear for his life. It is in Kjartan's interest, therefore, to kill you. I tell you this only so that you may consider whether you wish to return to Chirinchester, where the Danes have, he paused, influence. You will be safer in Wessex, but how long will Wessex last?
He evidently did not expect an answer, but kept pacing.
Ubba has sent men to Mercia, which suggests he will follow. Have you met Ubba?
Many times.
Tell me of him.
I told him what I knew. Told him that Ubba was a great warrior, though very superstitious.
And that intrigued Alfred, who wanted to know all about Storri the sorcerer, and about the rune sticks. And I told him how Ubba never picked battles for the joy of fighting, but only when the runes said he could win. But the once he fought, he did so with a terrible savagery. Alfred wrote it all down, then asked if I had met Halfdan, the youngest brother, and I said I had, but very briefly.
Halfdan speaks of avenging Ivar, Alfred said, so it's possible he will not come back to Wessex. Not soon, anyway. But even with Halfdan in Ireland, there will be plenty of pagans left to attack us. He explained how he had anticipated an attack this year, but the Danes had been disorganized and he did not expect that to last.
They will come next year, he said, and we think Ubba will lead them.
Or Guthrum, I said.
I had not forgotten him. He is in East Anglia now.
He glanced reproachfully at Breda, remembering her tales of Edmund. Breda, quite unworried, just watched him with half-closed eyes.
He looked back to me. What do you know of Guthrum?
Again I talked, and again he wrote. He was intrigued about the bone in Guthrum's hair, and shuddered when I repeated Guthrum's insistence that every Englishman be killed.
A harder job than he thinks, Alfred said dryly.
He laid the pen down and began pacing again.
There are different kinds of men, he said, and some are to be more feared than others. I feared Ivar the Boneless, for he was cold and thought carefully. Ubba, I don't know, but I suspect he is dangerous. Halfdan, a brave fool, but with no thoughts in his head. Guthrum, he is the least to be feared.
The least? I sounded dubious. Guthrum might be called the Unlucky, but he was a considerable chieftain and led a large force of warriors.
He thinks with his heart, Uhtred, Alfred said, not his head. You can change a man's heart, but not his head.
I remember staring at Alfred then, thinking that he spouted foolishness like a horse pissing. But he was right. Or almost right, because he tried to change me, but never succeeded.
A bee drifted through the door.
Neatgenger snapped impotently at it, and the bee droned out again.
But Guthrum will attack us? Alfred asked.
He wants to split you, I said. One army by land, another by sea, and the Britons from Wales.
Alfred looked at me gravely. How do you know that?
So I told him about Guthrum's visit to Ragnar, and the long conversation that I had witnessed, and Alfred's pen scratched, little flecks of ink spattering from the quill at rough spots on the parchment.
What this suggests, he spoke as he wrote, is that Ubba will come from Mercia by land, and Guthrum by sea from East Anglia.
He was wrong about that, but it seemed likely at the time.
How many ships can Guthrum bring?
I had no idea. 70, I suggested. 100?
Far more than that, Alfred said severely. And I cannot build even 20 ships to oppose them. Have you sailed, Uhtred?
Many times.
With the Danes? He asked pedantically.
With the Danes, I confirmed.
What I would like you to do, he said. But at that moment a bell tolled somewhere in the palace, and he immediately broke off from what he was saying. Prayers, he said, putting down his quill. You will come.
It was not a question, but a command. I have things to do, I said, waited a heartbeat. Lord.
He blinked at me in surprise, for he was not used to men opposing his wishes, especially when it came to saying prayers. But I kept a stubborn face, and he did not force the issue. There was the slap of sandaled feet on the paved path outside his chamber, and he dismissed us as he hurried to join the monks going to their service. A moment later the drone of a chant began, and Breda and I abandoned the palace, going into the town where we discovered a tavern that sold decent ale. I had been offered none by Alfred. The folk there were suspicious of us, partly because of the arm rings with their Danish runes, and partly because of our strange accents, mine from the north and Breda's from the east. But a sliver of our silver was weighed and trusted, and the wary atmosphere subsided when Father Beocca came in, saw us, and raised his inky hands in welcome. I have been searching high and low for you, he said. Alfred wanted you.
He wanted to pray, I said.
He would have you eat with him.
I drank some ale. If I live to be 100, Father, I began.
I pray you live longer than that, Beocca said. I pray you live as long as Methuselah.
I wondered who that was.
If I live to be 100, I said again, I hope never to eat with Alfred again. He shook his head sadly, but agreed to sit with us and take a pot of ale. He reached over and pulled at the leather thong, half hidden by my jerkin, and so revealed the hammer. He tutted. You lied to me, Uhtred, he said sadly. When you ran away from Father Willibald, we made inquiries. You were never a prisoner. You were treated as a son.
I was, I agreed.
But why did you not come to us then? Why did you stay with the Danes?
I smiled.
What would I have learned here? I asked. He began to answer, but I stilled him. You would have made me a scholar, Father, I said, and the Danes made me a warrior, and you will need warriors when they come back. Beocca understood that, but he was still sad. He looked at Breda. And you, young lady? I hope you did not lie. I always tell the truth, Father, she said in a small voice. Always. That is good, he said, then reached over again to hide my amulet. Are you a Christian, Uhtred? He asked. You baptized me yourself, Father, I said evasively. We will not defeat the Danes unless we hold the faith, he said earnestly, then smiled. But will you do what Alfred wants? I don't know what he wants. He ran off to wear out his knees before he could tell me. He wants you to serve on one of the ships he's building, he said. I just gaped at him. We're building ships, Uhtred, Beocca went on enthusiastically. Ships to fight the Danes. But our sailors are not fighters. They're, well, sailors. And they're fishermen, of course, and traders. But we need men who can teach them what the Danes do. Their ships raid our shore incessantly. Two ships come, three ships, sometimes more. They land, burn, kill, take slaves, and vanish. But with ships, we can fight them. He punched his withered left hand with his right and winced with the pain. That's what Alfred wants. I glanced at Breda, who gave a small shrug as if to say that she thought Beoka was telling the truth. I thought of the two Ethelreds, younger and older, and their dislike of me. I remembered the joy of a ship on the seas, of the wind tearing at the rigging, of the oars bending and flashing back the sun, of the songs of the rowers, of the heartbeat of the steering oar, of the seethe of the long green water against the hull. "Of course I'll do it," I said. "Praise God," Beoka said. "And why not?"
End of Disc 8.